Welcome to another episode of Debt Review with Dummies. And by dummies, we refer to your hosts. I am Corey, the dummiest dummy.
And I'm Zach. I'm so dumb, I once took a tape measure to bed just to measure how long I slept.
Zach, what is Debt Review with Dummies?
Corey, this podcast is all about the debt review process. How it is a wonderful process that can really help people deal with their debts, but also we take the opportunity to speak to people who play a vital role in the industry that help make it a success. So if you're curious about how Debt Review works, you're in the right place. If you'd like to hear about people who work in the space, you're in the right place. So Corey, recently, talking about being in the right place, I heard you were in the right place of Bloemfontein with a whole lot of debt counselors.
Yes, Zach, about 2 weeks ago, we had the privilege of spending some time with some debt counselors. The poor guys in Bloemfontein never get some love, so we decided to bring some stakeholders over there. We had lots of support from industry guys. Some of them sponsored, some of them spent time having speeches. We had about 32, 34 people attending, which is really, really nice. And that's quite big for Bloemfontein, I must say. So it was really, really nice having a lot of people there. We had a discussion. We had some great lunch. And it was just a fantastic experience to spend some time in Bloemfontein. And we were actually so blessed to have one of our guests on the podcast there. Well, not him himself, but the tribunal was there as well. So we're very grateful for their time as well.
Yeah, so I believe you had both the NCR and the NCT, as well as some other credit providers. And of course, one was there. What a wonderful event. And look, today we have an opportunity to catch up with one of those representatives. We talked about people who are in the industry. Well, we're going to talk to someone from the National Consumer Tribunal, the NCT. We're gonna go across to Pranessa now. Let me introduce Pranessa. We just want to say welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you on with us today. We know you quite well. It's a pleasure to work with you. But maybe you want to tell the listeners a little bit about who are you? What do you do? Who are you?
Thanks, Zach. Thanks, Zach, for the intro. Quite excited to be here. It is my first podcast, so this is exciting times for me on my own personal journeys as well. Thanks for extending the invite to me. So my name is Pranessa Mudli. I'm the registrar of the National Consumer Tribunal, and I've been at the tribunal for, this is going to be my 10-year anniversary in October. So it's been a while. And really excited to be here. It's one of the most exciting times that I've explored at the tribunal. There's so much happening, not just from an adjudication perspective, but, you know, the movement into social media, the exploring the different avenues that the tribunal can touch. Because, I mean, really, the tribunal's goal is, at the end of the day, linked to the Consumer Protection Act, Credit Act, and its values and its purpose. We're doing a lot, really excited, and that's who I am.
Pranessan, so give us a bit of a day in the life with Pranessan at the NCT. What's your typical day like?
Okay, so generally it starts very early in the morning, and I'm going to talk to you about my personal stuff as well. So it generally starts off with the kids, and getting the kids ready to school, and you know, all of that has to take place between 5 in the morning and 7:30, because at 7:30 we need to be rough and ready to go. From 7:30, the functions of the registrar, my functions then include a case management function. So I oversee the case management function. I have two case managers there. Oversee records and quality assurance function. I have a manager there as well that deals with that. Oversee communications. So that's external communication, stakeholder engagements, etc., as well as some research, which is a bit new for us. So there's quite a lot that's there. And from the case management, there's a lot of processes that are involved. So there's a lot of steps in the processes, steps within a process that we need to be involved in, that I need to be specifically involved in. And then there's a lot of other things that we get involved in. So I can tell you my day on probably the most calmest day for me is roughly a 10-hour day. And weekends, I can tell you as well, weekends is a thing that we have to work, but it really gets to me because, when I think about it, it's not a problem. I think at the tribunal, the one thing we're really passionate about is the purpose of what we do and what's really driving behind it. Not necessarily the stats, and I love to talk about stats, and I'll tell you a little bit more later. But really, what the stats mean, or what a single application means, and how that's helped someone, or how that's clarified a situation and helped many, or how that's helped a business grow their business in certain respects, And I really look at it and say that at the tribunal, the one thing you do get out of us is a team that works with passion and purpose. And I think another thing that we've been talking a lot about this year is our goal of being SASE. We want to be a SASE organization. We do it in everything that we do. And so really love it here at the tribunal. And I think the day in the life of the amount of work that needs to be done is actually nothing in comparison to the amount of impact we can have if we do things the way we want to do it.
Now we're talking, of course, from a position where we know what you do. The listeners, of course, they hear these very fancy words, tribunal, very fancy. They might be wondering, well, does that impact on me in any way as a consumer, out there? It's got the word consumer in it. How do I have any kind of interplay with the National Consumer Tribunal? When would that happen? What does it do for me? What would you tell people if you say, if you're explaining to someone, you meet someone, what does the NCT do?
I'll give you three key points here. The first is we adjudicate on debt review, certain types of debt review applications. So if a consumer is under financial difficulty, struggling financially, they visit a debt counselor. The debt counselors register on our system, and they apply for a debt review order after negotiating rates with the credit providers, and we either grant or refuse those orders. We tend to grant many. We grant about 98% of our orders, and well, that's the one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, there's, this car that you purchased that just broke a week later because the engine blew up. Or this fridge that stopped working, that you purchased not too long ago as well. And it's those issues that also come through to us that we can adjudicate on. But there is a process involved, and you have to run through your regulators first, your National Consumer Commission in that regard. There's also elements of like a reckless credit. You don't have a job, but you got credit. It's an interesting one. But things like that. So we adjudicate on those types of cases where consumers come to us generally through the regulators, and we adjudicate on debt review cases. So there's a wide variety of matters that we deal with. I can remember dealing with cases about a roof that collapsed. A car that was purchased in Johannesburg by a consumer that flew down from Cape Town, and on his way back, lo and behold, the car broke. There's many, many cases we've dealt with in terms of in terms of consumer protection. An interesting one was one related to a defective tombstone as well. So it's it's a wide variety of cases because what is consumer protection? Consumer protection is purchasing, and protection in that space. So, you can purchase a vehicle, you can purchase a loaf of bread. It's still bound by the Consumer Protection Act. And That is why you have the National Consumer Commission that deals with matters. You have different provincial consumer courts that deals with matters within their jurisdiction. You have the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud. You've got the NFO, the Credit Ombud used to be on their own before they moved into the NFO. So you have all these bodies that are focused on specifically consumer protection. And there's a need for it because you buy things every single day of your life. And for every and most of your assets, most of our bigger assets are purchased using credit as well. A lot of people purchase clothing and food using credit. So it's a big thing in terms of managing. And there's a wide variety of cases, but there's a process flow. And I'd like to think as as the tribunal, we're dealing with the matters that come through that haven't been resolved yet, and we're seeking to place a consumer or place a business in a point of resolution. So yeah, Zach, I
That's
think
actually no, go ahead.
no, I was just saying, yeah, I think it was just a wide variety of different things. So I hope the examples helped.
Yeah, no, you are not bored, that's for sure. Hey, they got lots going on, hey, Corey.
No, absolutely. I must say, working in the debt review industry, you see the tribunal at all these, different functions, but you never really think different kind of things. You always think debt review, so you don't really think about it. So it's quite interesting for me, all these different things like the tombstone. I mean, I would never have thought that. So it's quite interesting. And thanks for sharing that with us. So when you look at the debt review space that we are in, obviously, you go through the tribunal with a consent order. Could you kind of give us the main reasons why a court consent order might be rejected through the tribunal?
The most common reason is on the interest rates. And the reason for that is a maximum prescribed interest rate is formula based. So it shifts. It's not static. As interest rates increase, that changes. As it decreases, it changes as well. So you tend to find that sometimes what debt counselors do is they place an interest rate at a wrong value based on a previous fluctuation that occurred, for example. And that results in interest rates that's being agreed to that might be too high or over the prescribed interest rate. That is the one key reason that we reject. Lack of information tends to be the other. So, for example, there's a couple of credit providers that do fixed term agreements. Now, on a fixed term agreement, the consumer's made an agreement already on its term, on its rate. And what happens is when that interest rate drops, when the interest rate drops, you find that the dropping of the interest rate takes your prescribed minimum rates to below the rate of that fixed interest. And on face value, it needs to be rejected. What we tend to find is that if the actual contract is provided to us with it, that we grant it. So we tend to refuse quite a lot based on that. That's been quite a big thing for us. And the other smaller reasons is to do with citations. It's not really a smaller reason because citations is absolutely critical in the enforcement space. So citations often can lead to a bit of challenges from our side as well. So those I think are the key reasons why we've been rejecting orders. But I say rejecting orders. However, it's really about 2% of the orders that we receive that are rejected. And even on those 2%, we do allow debt counselors to file with us like an application to waive a fee to refile if there could have been an error on our side, just to guard against that. Because at the end of the day, we need to ensure that the parties and their investments are protected.
Now, Pranesan, when the listener hears this word tribunal, they might be thinking a room full of 20 people all listening. I don't know. Maybe they're thinking there's some Grecian pillars in the building looking very fancy because it sounds so fancy and formal. What's the actual kind of like, are we talking about, is this the same as a courtroom where these things are concerned, or how do people submit information to you? How are things discussed and ruled on? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. So from a submission perspective, we use email. For a lot of the applications, we receive it through email. I'm not talking specifically debt review now. I'm talking about all the different types of cases. But specifically for debt review, we've designed a case management system that allows parties to file using XML. My colleague Bax will just tell you, Bax is our chief information officer. He'd just tell you how it's an ingestion system. It takes information and it from one system and it ingests it into the next system, and it sounds incredibly awesome, and it is. So on the that's our one filing method, and then the other one is through the e-filing. That's more like, you know, how you used to capture an application on your SARS when you are capturing, for your tax for tax purposes. So we've got that option available, and as I mentioned, email is another big one for us. It doesn't result in many of our applications, the email avenue. However, it does result in all of our applications in terms of those that do not deal with debt review. So those are the avenues that's really available to us. How formal are we? I think take me back a couple of years, or taking you back a couple of years. We still have a courtroom. We extended and we got a second courtroom. And the courtroom had a lovely bench and a flag, and it looked all formalized and stuff. But to be honest, even in that formalized environment, we have an inquisitorial power as a tribunal. So it allowed our tribunal members to always dig a bit deeper. And it took away that level of formality when you had to compare it to a court, because certain questions could be asked that possibly could not be asked at a court. But now we run 99% of our hearings online. Our tribunal members are from all over the country. They attend from wherever they are, sometimes in different countries if that's where they need to be. But we have all our hearings online. From an accessibility perspective, we don't shy away from going to a province where a party needs us to be and have a physical hearing if that's the case, because at the end of the day, we're basing it on what is the most convenient for that consumer. And, so having this digital platform in which adjudication takes place makes us a little bit less formal in any event. And really, what we've done is we've taken this concept of adjudication, and we've taken this concept of formality, and we're trying to see what we can turn it into. And what we've turned it into is navigating social media a little bit, because we've realized that although we're a tribunal, although we're an adjudicator, it doesn't stop us from convening and sharing information with the industry. And that's taken us from a point of being a little bit aloof to industry and to consumers, and taking us a little bit towards them, to be able to engage and things like that. And it's worked out for us. I feel it's been a big thing, because I think that the one thing that the NCT has within this industry is a very good reputation.
No, I fully agree with that statement, and I know it's from our side, from the industry side. It's very nice to be able to have this conversation with the NCT, where previously you felt you didn't really have access to the NCT. It feels like you guys are more and more, out there and inviting, getting to the functions and stuff like that. It's very nice to have you guys there. I wanted to ask you, Friday afternoons, I think it's Friday afternoons, you or Friday mornings, you have a bit of a training session. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, I do. Friday mornings, actually, generally around 11 o'clock, when everyone is awake, we have a training session. It's really an ICT. It's a link between an ICT and a case management training, where we have our case officers and our ICT officers there, just offering guidance in terms of how to file applications. And some of the circulars, we've got circulars that guide debt counselors. I think we're on the verge of releasing circular 7, 11 at least, which is quite exciting. We're on the verge of releasing that. So it's just about giving guidance to industry. If any debt counselors want training, we're so open to it. We can have specialized sessions. We've been out to debt counselors' premises to offer them training. Really, I think what we're looking at from the tribunal's perspective, and I think we're looking at it from a wider economic perspective as well, is that the tribunal is really the most cost-effective avenue for debt review. No matter which way it's considered, it is the most cost effective. And in the space where you're dealing with debt review, where there's consumers that are financially stressed, cost effective is a big value for that consumer. And we are trying to make ourselves as accessible to debt counselors as possible. We're trying to make things as easy as debt counselors because as possible, because what our ultimate goal is for the consumers to benefit from this process. Because I know there is a filing fee attached to our filings and whatnot, and it's needed because it's needed for it's needed for the entire industry to function as much as it's needed for us to function as well. But when you look at the overall cost implications, the tribunal is the most cost-effective solution. And you know, we saw us talk about most cost-effective solution, and generally when someone thinks cost-effective, you think, ah, the quality is poor. I remember trying to buy stuff on like Facebook Marketplace, and you know, I got someone to fix my borehole from Facebook Marketplace, and it was most cost-effective. But I tell you, it wasn't cost effective in the long run. The tribunal is different to that. I mean, we've been really pushing out debt review. I think we've been sitting on like 21 days to get a debt review order out from the time we receive it. And 21 days, even to me, sounds a bit long, but we don't do anything with the case for 15 days because we're waiting for our pleadings period to finish. So really, from the time something's ready to adjudicate on, we're giving you an order in 6 days. I mean, that is absolutely phenomenal. Now, I never thought that would have happened when I entered the tribunal in 2015 and we were targeting 120 days to get an order out. I mean, it's hats off to IT, hats off to the leadership who made the decisions, hats off to a lot of the people in the NCT that are still driving it now. But when I walked into the tribunal, I could not see, I would never be able to tell you that I would foresee 6 days. When I was seeing 120 days and I was seeing 840 days on certain applications. So, yeah, it's just been a phenomenal turnaround over the last 10 years. And
Well,
it's a coincidence that it's linked up with my anniversary.
or is it? And then, yeah, I will just say, look, if you got some civil matters in Joburg and you're trying to get stuff at the courts, you're looking at dates in 2030, 2031 now. I mean, it's pretty scary. So, hats off to you guys for the phenomenal job there. But it makes you sound like debt counselors love to be in front of the NCT. There is a set of circumstances where we might love it slightly less.
Of course.
So, for our listeners, maybe you could explain a little bit about sometimes the National Credit Regulator is having a bit of a problem with maybe a debt counselor or maybe a credit provider. Something comes up and they would like a ruling on it. They come to you guys. So tell us a little bit more about that.
So, the NCR can come to us, so they can if they investigate and they decide that they want to bring an application, I think maybe I must start a little bit further back. The NCR can self-initiate an investigation, but they also can investigate based on a complaint that they receive. So let's take the instance that they've received a complaint from a consumer, about, let's use an example of reckless lending. And they've received this complaint, they investigated, and they are of the full view that reckless credit was given to the consumer. They can decide to refer the matter to us. However, if they have the view that reckless credit didn't take place, they can actually issue a consumer with a letter of non-referral. Now, you would think that the letter of non-referral, as it suggests, means it's not happening, nothing's happening for the consumer. That consumer then would, once it has that notice of non-referral, has access to the direct access to the tribunal to file their application and initiate the case on their own. But if we are talking to if we're talking to the NCR where they're bringing cases forward, they generally do it in terms of two sections. They this is what I found. They've done it via Section 140. They've done it via Section 57 of the NCA. And really, what that's done is to get a declaration of prohibited conduct, which is more your 140, and 57 is based on the deregistration that they're seeking. Yeah, and that's a big one. So they bring in the file the applications with us, and when they file an application with us, this is the email now, the email process that I was talking to earlier. So when they file that application with us, we do a quick assessment. Again, I say quick assessment, but this assessment was a 7-day assessment. It's like a 2-day assessment now. They do our team does a quick 2-day assessment, and they either issue a complete filing notice to say that they've met all the requirements. So they haven't. Now, what makes the tribunal different from a court is how the applications get filed to us. Usually, usually in courts, we're talking application process or action proceedings. The tribunal is basically premised on the application process, which is generally looking at a founding affidavit, an answering affidavit, or applying affidavit. And adjudication takes place generally on the papers with arguments by either party. Now, with the tribunal, we have a set of rules that's on our website that guides the tribunal. It creates forms. The forms allows consumers or the NCR for that matter to fill in a form to initiate the case. Now, while that seems tedious, the importance of it is the fact that it allows you to address the main aspects of your case because the form is also actually, surprise, surprise, a guidance document. Now, that is the purpose of that's how the case comes in. So, say for example, it's in a complete notice is issued. There's a period of pleadings where a party can file an answering affidavit. It is incredibly important if you choose to oppose this application that an answering affidavit be filed, because if you fail to file to file that answering within 15 days, the matter will proceed on a default basis. The tribunal will still have that inquisitorial power on a default application and won't just rubber stamp it. So it's still a full inquiry into the matter, but you don't have any defense placed on record. And if you choose to defend and you don't do it, it is very problematic. So in the event the answer is filed and the reply is filed, we have a full-blown hearing where parties are at liberty to provide evidence, argue their cases. And yes, the tribunal can issue a administrative fine. I think it's 10% of 10% of annual turnover or 1 million, whichever is the greater. We have issued orders in the past related to refunds for a period of about 3 years. We've asked for audits to be done to expand the impact of our judgment to all consumers that actually didn't come before us or decided, listen, it's too much, it's too big a fight to fight. And didn't raise it. Once these audits are done, it opens access to recourse to all of those consumers. So we've done quite a number of judgments like that. But that also, I mean, when these matters come to us, parties have a there is the Act does allow for a settlement for settlements to be entered into in to parties and for us to confirm it. In which case, if there's a default, there's always the ability to take further action on non-compliance with the tribunal order. It's a dangerous one. If you need to defend it, you defend it.
Yeah. And just so the listeners know, over the years, about 30 dead counselors have ended up in front of the tribunal and walked away without the right to practice anymore. They've essentially been shut down for serious breaches in the code of conduct or in the Act. So it is something that does happen. Very rare if you think about the thousands of people who were dead counselors, but it's very rare, but it can happen, and it's designed to protect consumers who are under debt review so that there's no abuse. And we applaud you for the role you play in that. And often we get to see in the news credit providers also being encouraged not to misbehave. Fines, audits, yeah. It really does. It has massive impact. Even recently, some interesting rulings. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But one of the questions we sometimes ask is, if a matter comes to you, sometimes we see a ruling go one way. Other times we see it go the other way. And we thought, well, maybe I expected it to go the same way as the previous one. How come sometimes we'll see similar matters with slightly different judgments?
No, it's an interesting one. So we do have the status of a high court, right? But we are adjudicating on cases, and different tribunal members can fully come up with a completely different conclusion because each judgment we have to our own entity or to our own tribunal members is persuasive in a way because it's not a level higher. It's not setting precedent to its own panel, in other words. So you tend to find that if a matter then goes further into the High Court and a High Court makes a decision, we then get bound by that. But our tribunal members can reach differing conclusions. And you know, sometimes it could be the same facts and a completely different argument, you know, that's being put forward. And it's a difficult one to track, especially that. But you could have a completely different argument that's being put forward on a similar set of facts, reaching a different conclusion. But more especially, you find that the tribunal members are exercising their own discretion per individual case and making their minds up per individual case. But what they do is they do read the other judgment. They do look at it and consider, can they be persuaded by the other judgment, or do they want to go in their own direction? And you find, and I mean, really, what that does is it develops our consumer protection jurisprudence, doesn't it? Because what you find is you'll have a judgment going one way, you'll have a judgment going another way. Industries absolutely flummoxed by the two judgments and decide to take it to the High Court. And the High Court makes a decision, and then now we have clarity in the law. And really, when legislation comes out in you know, in the 2000 in early 2000, 2007, 2006, and 2011, what you're finding is that the legislation that we have, or the jurisprudence that we have, is always going to be fresh for the next couple of years still. And because of that, any clarity that comes out of the High Court can only be seen as a blessing to the act itself, you know, and it gives guidance to the tribunal as well. But yes, we've issued many, many judgments. I can't count the number. I think we were talking in the thousands. We've issued many judgments, and even on those judgments that we did, you know, even on the thousands of judgments we did issue, it's not necessary that you'll have the same thing coming out of the other ones. I mean, I think about this case of FirstRand and Ludic. I mean, that's always the one that hits me. It's because the tribunal actually took a decision based on prescription and its application of prescription, and the High Court overturned us. I mean, it set a standard for every single prescription case that followed, and what it did is the arguments from the parties then changed, and that was where it started getting interesting because the argument was no longer the 3 years specifically. The arguments started turning into elements of continuing misconduct. So if it's continuing misconduct that 3 years since the cause of action then falls away, so you see that there's a change in argument, and what that does is it creates new jurisprudence. And as we continuously move through that circle, you find that what's effectively as a consequence happening is consumer protection legislation is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, with us doing what we're supposed to do.
Can you kind of give us an idea in the recent years, have there been an increase in applications or disputes through the tribunal?
In the last, it's been, wait, I'll talk to that. And I tend to like talking. I seem to be giving very long answers to your questions, but in any event, I think that's why you call me. Yeah, like when we started, like, I mean, when I started, we used to see 5,000 debt review applications a year and 9,000 debt review applications a year, and it was consistently growing. We used to use this word, unpredictable growth. That you'd find in many, many, many of our annual reports, the unpredictability of our growth. And it was growing consistently. We went from 5,000 to 9,000, jump to 18,000, jump to 28,000. We thought it's going to jump from there, and it stopped at 28,000, and it stopped at 28,000, and stopped at 28,000. It then moved to, I think, 30. It moved to 33,000 or 33,000. It moved to 40, and now we're sitting at 55,000. So, there has been quite a lot of growth. Very still a bit unpredictable in a way because the levels of growth are differing year on year. I mean, you had that flattening of the curve. You had that flattening of the curve that occurred, and you didn't know where the baseline or where the new baseline would be, but it was interesting. In the last financial year, there's been growth. In the year before that, there's been growth. You wonder what's that to do with. I mean, there's been a lot of changes recently. That interest rate was during COVID time at its all-time low, and then it continuously had grown and grown and grown. And if you look at the CB, the Credit Bureau monitoring reports that the NCR does, they have this line that speaks about those consumers experiencing financial difficulty. And what I found is that as that interest rate kept on creeping up, those consumers that was just above the line fell below. And that's possibly to do with the growth. So there's a lot of external factors that really influence the amount of applications that come to us. The other thing I'm hoping is true is that over the last year, we've spent a phenomenal amount of time out in industry. We've been at any engagement that anyone has invited to us to that we thought we'd be gain that there'd be benefit in. And what we're really hoping is that also a lot of that engagement is resulting in growth, because even if the number of debt review in totality is not increasing, our market share needs to be increasing, because the moment that that increases, it means that there's more consumers getting access to the best debt review solution that's on the market at the moment.
Yeah, and I think many of us would love to have the NCT handle every single debt review matter, consented or not. We'll all think about that for one day. But for the moment, as an organization, I think you have quite a wide view of what's happening because of all these cases moving through your space. Are you seeing any trends or any issues that are coming up, any common themes across these cases? Is there anything that you feel the industry needs to take cognizance of?
Listen, for me, the big thing is education, right? Because the w way I'm looking at it, or the way I'm seeing it, is a lot of things that happen don't necessarily need to happen if consumers were fully under if cons consumers understood this financial landscape that we find ourselves in as adults with very little education on it before we become adults. And you find like it, and this is not a problem, but you find that when you're purchasing your first car, you're so excited, so super excited to get access to that vehicle, that you actually pay no attention to what the rate that you're being given is, or the fact that you could negotiate your rate if you needed to negotiate your rate, but I think what I'm finding is that there's a lot of companies that's out there that's blatantly doing things that they shouldn't be doing, blatantly operating outside the consumer, outside the National Credit Act, and they are taking consumers for a ride. And there's been, from my understanding, some investigations on that. And I suppose we'll see those cases come to the tribunal in due course. But you find that it's operating completely, not even skimming the law. Operating completely outside of it with no intention of doing it. And what that does, and I think this is my industry-based, my question to the industry, I suppose, is what this is doing is it's absolutely tarnishing the reputation of not just the debt counseling industry, the entire credit industry that we have in this country. And, it's strong action, strong enforcement, and those are the things that can help, resolve these issues. And hopefully, as time goes on, those sorts of practices will stop. But I mean, it does require the industry to come in as well, and and alert people to these issues, or alert regulators, for example, to these issues. Because, I mean, you can't have a person in every place of the country, but you can have eyes there, and your eyes are your stakeholders, and I think that is the avenue that needs to be taken. We do see some cases. I mean, back to the normalities, is we do see some cases related to reckless credit. We do see quite a number of cases on that. We do see some cases related to credit bureaus and credit bureau reports. We do see cases related to related to trying to get out a debt review through clearance certificates, or forcing the debt counselor to compelling a debt counselor to issue a clearance certificate. But I think really the big ticket items is the complete disregard with many, many businesses that choose to operate in a way that has nothing to do with the legislation that's supposed to govern it.
Zach, do you think it's about that time for the magic wand? Can I hand it to you? Do you want to take the
Oh,
magic
thank
wand
you very
today?
much, because Pranessa might not know this, but we have a magic wand and it allows you to do absolutely anything you want in this industry to change it. So now that it's in my hand, I can do amazing things. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give it to you, Pranessa. I'm going to give you absolute ability to change one thing in the industry, and it works perfectly. What would you change and why would you change it if you had that ability?
Wow, talking about putting someone on the spot. And especially since, so no, so
We
I
can come
think
back to that one.
if,
We can come back to that one if you want.
no.
That's yappy.
I'm happy to take it on, because I think it's a very interesting question. Because there's so much that can change. But I've got my finger somehow pressed on the word sustainability for some reason. It's like a key on my computer right now. For an ecosystem to exist, and for an ecosystem to remain efficient and effective, that word sustainability is crucial to it. So I think for me, I've been in so many engagements with different industry players, and that word sustainability has come in. Now, I haven't obviously gone into the investigations of each different industry player to talk to really give you a full understanding, a full picture of sustainability within each different player within industry. But I think there's a key theme that as you move from sustainability to a point of unsustainability, the protection that is provided by the Consumer Protection Act and the National Credit Act seems to start falling away as everyone in the industry moves from a place to feeling that they're in a sustainable environment to feeling that they're in an unsustainable environment. Now, sustainability doesn't always mean charging more fees, and I know that could be the context in which it's taken. But sustainability holistically, looking at it not just from a fee perspective, but from a value perspective as well, is the value that's coming out of the system, what is the value that was intended? And I'm raising this specifically as an enforcement-based question. Because once we issue an order, right, the sustainability of it is that that order would be enforced. A company would be fined, for example, if we ruled in that way. And if they were fined, that financial sanction would change behavior. That financial sanction would change industry behavior. The refunds to the consumers would put them in a position that they would be in, or they would naturally be in. And right now, when it comes to enforcement, what's needing to happen is a matter needs to move from the tribunal into the courts, into the formal courts, for that order to be enforced. And that process, for me, might not be necessary if the tribunal, for example, could enforce. And I find that system, then that whole circle, when you're talking about what's meant to happen, starting from, for example, let's use the debt counselor chain, from the consumer to the debt counselors to the credit providers to the NCR if needed, to ourselves, right through to the finality, back to the starting point. I think if sustainability in terms of an entire process is exists, then we're on the pathway to really giving meaning and life to what the CPA and the NCA intended to achieve. Now, don't get me wrong, our CPA and NCA is absolutely progressive, brilliant pieces of legislation. Yes, it can always change here and there, but it's from a structural perspective, from a it is absolutely brilliant, life-changing legislation. In fact, think back to 2008. Where would we be today if the NCA was not released before 2008? When the rest of the world suffered, what happened with us? And that is the power of national, that's the power of credit in a country. And the regulation of credit becomes absolutely critical when the power of credit is so high. So, yes, I spoke about sustainability, but really where I'm bringing it to is not just from a only industry player perspective. I believe it needs to be there as well, but also from a perspective of closing the gap in a case. So people feel free, consumers and credit providers can rely on the system, because the system speaks to them as well. So I hope I've
No,
got
it's
the
good.
magic wand. I'm going to return the
Yeah.
magic wand to
You
you
give
guys because you put me in the spot. But I think that word was just stuck in my head the moment you asked the question. I just needed to figure out why.
If you give me the wand, I'll just make everyone wear red hats. Sorry. There are a lot of people who are listening now that they know a little bit more about what the NCT does. They know the important role you play. And they've heard some of the information that you've shared about debt review. If you had a message for a consumer who's maybe under financial stress at the moment, and they're a little bit unsure about what to do about their debt, I mean, let's just put it out there. They're taking strain right now, and it's out of control. What do you recommend?
No, listen, I think it's the mechan the way in which they identify a debt counselor to help them that is the most important thing. You have the National Credit Regulator. They have a list of debt counselors. Those debt counselors are registered, they are trained. You have different associations, different debt counseling bodies. And the debt counseling body's purpose really is to, I suppose it's also involves the education and lifting the standards of debt review. So you have those avenues to contact. The suggestion from me will always be to, look, do your research first, find out the debt counselors that are in the industry, that's making an impact on the industry, that's doing things right, because the industry perception is not good. And because there's a industry, because the industry is perceived in such a way, because the industry is perceived in such a way, you might find people who need debt review veering away from it, looking for other alternatives, or looking for the quickest access point to debt counseling. Debt counseling is not a quick access point. It's not a quick exit point. It's designed to help you at a stage in your life where you need the assistance. And also through the process of debt review, it's also giving you the ammunition you need to move forward once you get out of the debt review process. So if you're going to be spending 5 to 6 years working with debt counselors, I mean, surely you should research them. I mean, I'm just thinking, I married my wife after knowing her for 1 year. And that worked out for me. So, spend time in researching. There's 6 years of your life, 5 years of your life that's dedicated. You're in this process for 6 years. Find people that you would be able to trust, that has a sterling reputation in industry. Because those are the guys that are going to guide you through the next phase of your life.
Well said, sir. Well said. Well, we just wanted to say, these dummies, we really appreciate you spending time with us. It was so much fun spending time with you today. And I also want to say thank you for making you guys self-available. It's so nice to engage with you guys. So we just want to say thank you very much from our side as well, from the industry side, that you guys join us. And thank you very much for your time today.
No, perfect. Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, Corey, I don't know about you, but I feel slightly less dumb than when we started this podcast. It's nice to learn what the NCT does, and interesting to see how they operate, the decisions they've made over the years, why sometimes they want go one way, another way. Interesting to see the interaction with the debt counselors there. What a nice time. Yeah, thanks to Pranesan.
Yeah, seriously fun chatting to the industry stakeholders. And as usual, Zach, thank you very much for your time. Pranesh, thank you for your time. Thank you to our listeners. And we'll see you on the next episode of Debt Review with Dummies.
Maybe.